The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined this morning by John Lee, Executive Editor of the Daily Mail Group in Ireland, Joan Mulvihill, who is Digitalisation Lead at Siemens, and Francis Fitzgerald, former Taoiseach and former MEP. And where we start is with matters in the US. Obviously, there were those protests across the US, which we will discuss, and that military parade. But there was also political assassinations. Melissa Hartman and her husband, Mark, both shot and killed in what is being deemed a political assassination by the governor, Tim Walz, in Minnesota. And another politician and his wife, that being John Hoffman, shot, although it looks like they will survive, both of them now in surgery and the suspect on the run. Francis Fitzgerald, previously on this programme, both in Ireland and beyond, we had discussed the implications of coarsening of the political discourse, the binary nature of it, the aggression, the spite that now defines politics. Is this it coming to fruition?
Well, we always talked about what it was like online and the levels of violence against everyone online, but of course, particularly women. And now we have this really chilling assassination in America, a US politician and her husband assassinated. Seems to have been an exchange of fire with the police, but the suspect is still on the run. And there is a video of her where she was passing legislation that she was very unhappy about in relation to a budget which actually stopped money for asylum seekers. So whether it's linked to that, which seems a bit not exactly what you'd expect. So the motives are very unclear. But whatever the motives, to be shot dead as a state representative and her husband and another couple assassinated as well. Well, they're in surgery, as you say. So I think it's extraordinarily chilling. I mean, we've seen this in the UK. I've heard the Speaker of the House of Commons had to bring in extraordinarily stringent rules and reporting about online violence because it's so often, you know, becomes offline violence. And even here we had our former Commissioner Noreen O'Sullivan doing a report on how to handle it, try to get better reporting mechanisms, making it more straightforward to report so that the police build up a sort of a portfolio of information about who is making these threats and they can assess them properly. But it's incredibly chilling. I mean, America, there's so much going on in America at the moment, but this assassination, it must strike terror in the hearts of everybody, including politicians.
It's ironic. We were talking to Patrick O'Donoghue just before the break about the desire by the US State Department to make sure that Commissioner Mann doesn't regulate to chill what they see as free speech. That story juxtaposed in the same paper with those political assassinations. And of course, the same thing, the predictable has happened. It has now split down binary political lines, trying to figure out what political persuasion the assassin is and attribute it to that.
And you
persuasion.
See, on the free speech, you have this complete contradiction between the way the EU is approaching it and the way America approaches it. America wants less regulation. EU is very keen on regulation, although less than it was keen before, less keen.
Now, of course, John, when this kind of thing happens, there will be people who will say, look, there has always been, ranging from Sirhan Sirhan all of the way up, there have been lunatics with guns who want to kill politicians. This is no different than it's ever been.
I think I was on your show probably back prior to 2020 when I was asked a similar question. And I recall saying in my naivety that, you know, in 1968, we were having riots, students being shot out of hand by the National Guard, who, let's not forget, are on the streets of Los Angeles right now. There was presidential candidates being shot in hotel kitchens. And we're nowhere near that now. So that's pre-2020. Now we're back at that. The United States, I felt the system would hold up in countering this populist movement under Donald Trump. It's clearly not. His attitude to world affairs and domestic affairs is now spreading across the globe where dictators believe they can commit unilateral invasions of Ukraine. Formerly democratic states that many of us admired and supported, like Israel, are now committing unilateral action because they know there'll be no blowback from the United States, the world's policemen. So we're exactly where we thought we wouldn't be in the United States. I don't know what the end to it is. You know, Trump, a bit like previous dictators in the 1930s, who we won't name because they may be a bit over the top to compare him to those, has said what he wants to do. You know, he has said this all along, and we all saw it as a kind of a joke. There was a feeling in pre-2016 that Halisny can't be that bad. There was a feeling this time around, and I spoke to senior people in his former administration and in Washington when I was over there in March. Ah, he'll go off and play golf in the summer and he'll lose interest in all this, but it's getting worse and worse, and I don't know what the end to it is. Only hope is the Democrats get themselves together. And I know that's a biased view, but you know, the great tragedy of this is that the Democrats allowed him back in.
And of course, we're seeing images that seem out of place in the US from over the weekend. Military parades where the army is marching past bleachers with senior politicians. That's the kind of thing that has previously been associated with China, with North Korea. It's not something you tend to think of with the US.
If you saw that in black and white, you'd think it was from another time. And we know what time I'm talking about. It looked like something more from the 1930s in Europe. And that is horrifying. And I think it's to put this assassination in the context of that. These things happened on the same day. This is a fundamental breakdown of what's going on in the US. And I think, you know, you add to that the senator that was arrested and handcuffed the other day for asking a question at a press conference. And we're talking about freedom of speech and how they want to protect freedom of speech over there. And they're saying that we're being too tight and everyone should have, in Europe, you're regulating too much and everyone should have freedom of speech. Well, it appears you do not have freedom of speech in America, of all places. And in fact, it's America who are checking our social media posts and deciding whether or not we get in or get out. So the level of gaslighting and double standards and hypocrisy that's going on in the States right now, the idea of a military parade is actually disgusting to me to look at. And I compare that to the front page of the paper, and there's lovely Princess Catherine, Kate Middleton, on the front page of the Trooping of the Colours of the UK. And we look at that as some pretty lovely, beautiful floral parade. And then you look at what's going on in the States, and it is hard. It's hard to believe that the shooting of a US politician is page two and a relatively small article relative to the size of what it is as an indicator of what's going on.
But if we take all of those things individually, surely the Americans can say there is a good, coherent policy reason for doing any of this. The army is a quarter of a millennium old and is significant in the history of America. Why not have a parade to celebrate it? Likewise, social media, we have long believed there should be free speech. We are not going to allow anybody to chill that free speech on social media. So all of it fits, I would have thought, with pre-existing American ideology, no?
I think it's the confluence of all of those things with a leader like Donald Trump, who, as to John's point, is doing exactly what he said he was going to do and everyone thought he wouldn't. I mean, if I'm Kamala Harris right now, my level of Cassandra syndrome is off the scale. She did say he was going to do everything he said he was going to do. We did say, we were told that his last term was a dry run and this is really where the rubber hits the road.
He had a working plan for this, you know, for this administration. It was all written out. I think people underestimated it, the work that had been done. It's all spelt out there.
There's the project 2025 Heritage Foundation. Yeah.
People didn't think he was going to implement it. But what's very clear is that not just him, but all of the people around him and the complete administration, the feedback I'm getting is that there isn't, you know, any space between what he wants to do and the administration. They're all tied up with this ideology. And it is about power, and it's about a transfer of power. I mean, you talked, John, about the Democrats. It's about a transfer of power from the Democrats, all the institutions they've built up over the years, to his people, his crony. And it's absolutely barefaced. And then you have the Los Angeles
situation.
But is it
not also a delivery on the mandate that he was democratically given?
This is what he said he would do.
That's what America voted for. They get what they wanted.
I think what's interesting is happening is the cultural shift. Because he's saying all bets are off and he can do whatever he likes, I think that's probably entering the psyche of American people who are part of that MAGA movement. And they feel they can do whatever they like. They feel that it's perfectly okay to maybe go in and assassinate a politician that you don't agree with. There is a lawlessness that is breaking out over there. And I don't mean in terms of the peaceful protesters. I mean in terms of the lawlessness of the response of the of the enforcement of the police and the National Guard.
Text pointing out, we have parades every Easter Rising ceremony and a huge one in 2016 with planes and helicopters, brackets the few that we have. So I wouldn't be getting our knickers in a twist here. 53106
at a cost. But the United States had always got had an ideological opposition to the display of military might like that. And back to MacArthur, General MacArthur promoted parades after the victory in 1945, and Truman clamped down on any kind of assuming of the military of too much power, and right through the Cold War it wasn't done. This is a breaching of a ceiling that we've never seen before.
What do you make of the No Kings protests then? I mean, is that the largest national exercise in shutting a stable door after a horse has bolted? I mean, fair play, lads.
But you know, resistance has to begin somewhere.
Would it not have been used to begin at the last election?
No, but it has to begin somewhere. And I think you're beginning to see the seeds. You're not seeing much from the Democrats, I have to say, except from Gavin Newsom in California.
Well, they seem to be completely...
You're seeing the people on the streets now.
It's funny. Even you read the figures and you get a grasp of how large the United States is. There was protests in 2,000 cities. I mean, the fact that they have 2,000 cities to have protests in, that resistance is there, and it shouldn't be. And you know, when I spoke at the outset, there might be a sense of deep pessimism. Trump will constantly shout from the rooftops that he's some massive mandate. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just going from memory here, the margin was about 300,000. Now, we know he slayed the Electoral College, but he slayed the swing states. So, but the majority was not that big. The level of incompetence in the Democratic Party is beyond belief. I recall being in the United States. I was on your program around then in 24. I've been there since a few times. And in January 2024, there's this allegation there was some kind of cover-up in the media of the state Joe Biden was in. And let's face it, we all know what his problems now. Everyone I met, and I was over large parts of Florida, not just Miami, but the West Coast, was saying to me, and I'm just telling you what people told me, this man is not capable of being our president. He's senile. He's got severe health problems. And the immigration problem at our borders here is completely unacceptable. And I think the week I arrived there, 250,000 illegal immigrants across the border. So the Democrats did not put up an opposition to this guy. There still is the possibility that they can. And when you refer to Kamala Harris, then we look at the size of the country. She was given she was thrown a hospital pass in July of 2024. The size of that country, she could not carry out a proper campaign. She could not go up against a guy who's essentially been canvassing, has been electioneering for 10 years. So hope is not lost. But rather than focus your hope on one party, I think we have to. But somebody, this Republican Party has been overtaken by this movement. There is light at the end of the tunnel. But this man has to be removed from power democratically.
Another one saying, folks, if you found the US military parade...
Sorry, I know he can't stand, but...
Then you had better turn off your TVs for Bastille Day in France. The US is broken, but a commemorative military parade is hardly the final straw.
Let's face it, it's pretty ubiquitous around the world. People like, my father was in the army. I'm very proud of the Irish army and the peacekeeping roles they played over the decades. And I think it's okay, absolutely acceptable to be proud of your military forces. But it's a question of degree. And I think what's more interesting about what's happening at the moment is this sort of ideological change and the fact that it's sort of, as John says, 50-50. You look at Poland, the exact same, you know, razor tiny majorities to go into power. And, you know, populations, I'm surprised at Poland, actually, after all they've been through. But no, it's 50, more or less 50-50, tiny margin for the more conservative right-wing guy, gets a.
And do you see it as the same issues around the world? Is it?
I do see a very generic movement, actually. I mean, I think it is democracy failing. And I think it is authoritarianism taking over. And I think there's an enormous challenge to democracy. And if democracy doesn't start delivering more for people, whether it's housing or services or whatever. But I think, you know, you have fundamental values being questioned at the moment, like rule of law in the States, sending in the troops. Never since 68, they haven't sent in troops like that without the authority of the governor. I think the basic institutions are being undermined, international legal bodies undermined. So it's a very serious time. I never thought I'd see it.
But I think
it's a complete turnaround.
I think, to be fair, The military parade thing, I get that when it's a military parade in a relatively benign situation, but you cannot look at this in isolation.
Oh, that's
this
the
is not
point.
This is not Bastille Day. This is not the, you know, a commemoration of, you know, the 1916 rising. This is a man who is standing there as the president of that country talking about our armies. We fight, and we win. And that is because the man wants to clearly fight. And I think that's it's to put it, you can't look at it in isolation. You can't look at it and treat it like what other countries are doing. This is the first time that they've done something really radical like this in the same week that they have sent in the National Guard to California in breaching of all of their own federal laws around a state having autonomy. And you only bring in the National Guard when it's been called in by the governor. And the governor says, what the hell are you doing here? So it's not about a parade. And I, to that person's regarding my knickers in a twist, to they use their expression about
this? I think it was everybody's.
Everybody's. But it was, well, I just think it's just, I think it's naive to look at it in isolation and not to put it in the round of everything that's going on over there right now and who is standing there leading it on this
massive his stage. Birthday.
And
both
don't
forget to mention that.
Bastille France's wedding anniversary.
The French army haven't been involved in successful military action in 100 years, more than 100 years. We're talking about the preeminent military power on the planet, who have always, through all the noble presidents they had and the ignoble ones like Nixon, there was never this carry on because they knew the messages that was sending internationally.
Speaking of which, and I know this may be slightly tangential to the core underpinning issue, the scale of it, I thought, given the scale of the US
we
Army.
You unimpressed.
Yeah, I figured, okay, well, if there's one thing the Americans are going to do, military parades, they are going to do this better than anybody else on the planet, I'd say North Korea feels unthreatened.
Yeah, it was like one of those St. Patrick's Day parades with the tractor going down the middle of the street.
Our 1916 stuff was nearly as good.
A lot of people were very busy doing the No Kings protest marches instead.
Well, presumably not the army. I think
not the army.
But there was none in Washington, interestingly. Obviously, they're clever enough to know if the army are there.
At a cost of 30 cents, if you want to get in touch, 087-1400-106 on WhatsApp. With me is Joan Mulvihill, digitization lead at Siemens, Francis Fitzgerald, former Taoiseach and, of course, MEP, and John Lee, executive editor of the Daily Mail Group in Ireland. As there is every weekend, and I suspect there will be in perpetuity, there is a lot of news in respect of housing, and most of it is suggesting that what the government is doing is confusing an already dysfunctional market and reducing the likelihood of apartments getting built. We'll discuss that after this break. John Lee and, of course, panel Francis Fitzgerald, former Taoiseach, Joan Mulvihill, digitalization lead at Siemens, and John Lee, executive editor of the Daily Mail Group in Ireland. Housing continues to be the issue that the government is so far incapable of resolving. And John Lee and John Drennan both have a piece in the Mail on Sunday today looking at the changes that are being brought. And if I'm reading between the lines, John, the sense that I get is the two issues are, one, the shoebox apartment is on the way back thanks to changes in apartment building, and two, the market is now confused because everything changes every week.
Yes, and I think Frances is backtracking there, but she's correct. She's probably worried about a phone call from Simon Harris about her presidential bid might have gone there now, but she's 100% correct. This government will stand and fall on delivery, much as they like to get into other areas, if they don't deliver on housing. And along with that, water infrastructure and everything else, sounds very boring. They're going to be in major trouble. What kind of legacy would Micheál Martin have? What kind of legacy would Simon Harris have if we roll around to 2029, maybe get that far, and this is still the mess it is? To me, I ask the rhetorical question, does all that, all those announcements last week to do with rent pressure zones and everything else, when ministers we spoke to didn't understand what the hell was going on, don't expect me to explain it to your listeners. But is it going to increase supply? I mean, we've Colin McGurk speaks in our paper to representatives of small landlords. Are these measures, which seem to me nothing but prohibitive to small landlords? There are 45% of the landlords in this country are deemed to be small landlords. That's one aspect. Does that drive people out of them? I'm asking rhetorical questions I don't have the answers to. Another proposal now that will be coming out in the next couple of weeks that was leaked to me over the weekend is that we get rid of a lot of the restrictions, call them restrictions, on apartment building to make it cheaper to build apartment blocks. in a conversation that I had with the person who was telling me about this, I did, to their chagrin, say, well, does this mean the return of the shoebox apartment? And it seems to be an idea now you build small apartments and that's somehow going to solve things.
But even that, if there isn't clarity around those things, does it not have an immediate chilling effect on the market where construction companies and builders will say, well, if there's a scope to get higher density or if there's a scope to get different yields, we'll hold off and wait until all this settles before we do anything?
Of course it does. So that's what I'm saying, we've had this blizzard of announcements last week. There were ministers quizzed all over the place and they honestly did not seem to understand exactly the ins and outs of all of it. So I don't know what solution they have. Francis might tell us, as a former cabinet minister and a Taoiseach, is it the right thing or the wrong thing to admit, and leave aside all of that, that there is simply not the capacity in our market to build the number of houses required. That seems to be plain as day to me. Now, is that a good political move or a bad political move to put your hands up and say, do you know what? That crazy, silly target we come up with last year of 60,000 a year, the plainly wrong calculation of completions that was leaked or that was put out, sorry, during the general election, we shouldn't have done that. We knew it was wrong. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? And you roll around to 2029, 2028 and say, okay, listen, we got close enough to what we said we were going to do because we admitted we cannot do that.
Do you get elected on that basis? Do you get returned on that basis if you do that?
If housing is still the problem, and there is, let's clarify, there are housing issues all over the world. There are housing problems in the United States and in the UK and in Germany that are coming about. It is not soluble. But I think if it is in the dysfunctional state that it is right now and has been for 10 years, come election time, they're going to get slaughtered on it anyway. So maybe Francis could outline to us how you deal with this politically, and rather than puzzling my mind with RPZs and everything
else. The first thing I'd say is you don't judge it today. They will be judged in 2.5 years, yeah, depending on the numbers. That's the first point.
They want to get peddling,
The question then is, how much is in this that will actually lead to the kind of solutions that are needed? And I would say it's make or break for the government. And they know that. So, I mean, this has been taken extremely seriously by the government. And that's why you have, about 10 decisions within the announcement this week. There's a very big communications piece that has to be done. I totally agree that to explain, it's quite confusing at first glance. When you dig into it, what you find is that the decisions that have been taken are about making sure that investors come back in to build more apartments. That's going to happen out of this. It's 300,000 over the lifetime of the government.
Well, sorry, just even on that, it's not like the private equity community is now roaring and saying, oh, delight, we see returns that we didn't see before. It's very hard to find investors who reacted to this week's announcement with joy and gusto.
Well, you do see some of them where they are saying a step in the... You see, for example, Eddie Byrne, Iris Reid, he said the new rules were not perfect, a step in the right direction. I didn't believe the government could give more protection to tenants whilst also making conditions for investment even slightly better. This somehow achieves that. You have the rent pressure zones then extended to all parts of the country, which is supportive of tenants. That's another good step. You have the cap of the 2% max on those properties. So I think you have messages going out to renters, to investors. That's what makes it confusing. There's so much being dealt with here. But I do believe that you cannot judge it today. There is definitely a communication piece. I mean, it's all over the Business Post, various ministers saying we need more time to really come to grips with this. So it does need to settle. And if there's more laws, for example, about the Residential Tenancy Board coming in so that they can have more sanctions on landlords who break the rules, then it better get settled by the summer. Because if it isn't settled, exactly the point, the investment isn't going to come. Renters aren't going to be sure. Landlords will pull out if they really think there's still uncertainty. There's also protection from landlords who own less than 4 properties,
which is the vast majority of landlords and housing stock in the country.
Yeah, but then you have the big landlords, of course.
But a huge amount of stock is held. When we talk landlords, we tend to think of big corporates.
They are excluded from much of the more difficult parts of this. So there is protection for those. So I think people will have to understand this slowly but surely. But it's 2.5 years you'll judge it when you see what are the numbers in 2.5 years.
Joe? I think that's the point. I think it's very hard for people to get their head around the idea that the new legislation, the new rules are going to support both tenants and landlords. So from a communications point of view, that is probably difficult for people to trust and get their head around. I do understand to a certain extent that it has been brought in to protect and support those smaller landlords more and to keep them in the market. But I think, and I just caught the tail end of it on TV the other evening, and Sarah McInerney was challenging the minister about that a lot of these benefits won't come through for another 7 years, and was almost criticising him for that, which I kind of took umbrage with, because this is the point. We keep looking for short-term solutions to what is a very long-term strategic plan. We criticise the governments when they don't take a view strategically, because we want you to act strategically and not just short-term. And then when they don't give short-term solutions, we're annoyed with them as well. These are really, really complex issues. It is capacity, not just for construction and workers, but it is capacity around energy and water and schools and all of that as well. And also taking a lot of that development outside of Dublin as well. And I think that's
To give you a case in point, I mean, ironically, your own company back in the day, it was 1925.
It's 100 years this year.
24 was the recommendation to build Ordna Cruachaine.
Yeah.
Within 10 years, it was built and supplying 80%+ of the country's electricity needs. Now, if we can turn that around in a 10-year period and spend 20% of our GDP year after year after year to achieve that, how can we not start to build houses in the same time frame?
Oh, what a perfect question. And actually, that's a but it's true. And I heard Jack Chambers, there was one article, it was the start of this year, and he said, we need another Ardna Cruachaine moment. And it is so true. But one, and I've spoken a lot about Ardna Cruachaine and that centenary this year, because it is obviously a really big deal for Siemens, but it's a big deal for the country more than anything. It was that we had that vision, that long-term ambition. We took untested technology at that time. Hydroelectric power was untested. It was the biggest dam in the entire world in 1925. The biggest dam in the world now is in China. We had the capacity to do that when we had A, no money, and B, no anything. Like, all we had was
There's two points I'd make about this. One is the level of participative democracy we have in Ireland. We've always been really proud of that. And some people would say it's out of control when it comes to planning. And I tend to agree that we absolutely need to see the changes in planning.
As in, so single individuals can stop entire projects. Exactly. Is that what that means?
Right? Absolutely.
That's the point. If you tried Ardna Cruachaine today, what would happen? So you'd have 10 judicial reviews from local farmers and everything else. And this is part of the problem here we have is that a lot of what's coming out now, not all of it, and the RPZs and other things last week weren't necessarily. This is the enactment of a planning bill that was brought in last October, which will give your listeners an indication of how slowly all this has to operate. But in that bill, there are proposals to deal with judicial reviews. And the last thing they're going to deal with from that bill are judicial reviews. And to my eyes, and clearly Francis, as a former senior member of government, sees that the problem is any time you try and have an innovative project in Ireland, it's opposed in the courts.
A lot of text coming in.
This applies to asylum seeking as well. The number of reviews that were there, I reduced them because I thought it was right to reduce them. But it's still an issue in relation to the number of judicial reviews that are taken.
And I have to say, just I want to correct myself. I said there was no objection. There was a lot of debate and objection within government at that time. But you're right. It was the participation of the local community that those objections were not the level that we're seeing.
The state government at the time would have banged you up. Not forget.
A more chilling environment at the time. I was a small landlord with three properties, both sold in the past month. One tenant didn't pay for 20 months, ignored the RTB, and we were left with no help and other property subletting. HAP didn't want to know. We got both out at great expense to ourselves and sold them. Never again. Any small landlord needs to get out. Another, I was a small landlord with three properties, both sold in the past 3 months. Another, developers not going to build apartments unless there's a queue of investors to buy them. Nothing has been done on taxation to create that demand, which I assume means Section 23s or something along those lines. Anton, the government should buy one of the building companies and get on with the job. How come nobody talks to the landlords who supply 85% of the market? Quote, small landlords like me, you're talking and listening to the wrong people. Well, if you want a view 53106, or if you have a view 53106.
Definitely need reassurance.
At a cost of 30 cents, or 087-1400-106 on WhatsApp. Francis, just want to get your view, both as former Justice Minister and also as former Chair of the Women's Council. The story in respect of the family courts needing a radical overhaul. This is the suggestion that the use of experts in family courts needs to be reanalyzed because it is delivering neither for victims nor for the process.
It's a very interesting new report that Women's Aid has commissioned from a number of universities. The bottom line on it is they're talking about the constitutional changes I brought in the referendum for children were about, in all cases with children in these courts, you should have the best interests of the child and the voice of the child should be respected. And this report is saying that that isn't being implemented enough within the courts and that some of the experts who are brought into court, first of all, are not qualified enough and secondly, are really building on this concept of parental alienation, which generally means that it often means that women who are trying to protect their children are accused of alienating the children from the other parent. And the question is, how do you make sure that the voice of the child, the best interests of the child are paramount? And this has been bubbling under the surface. I remember meeting many groups in relation to this when I was in justice. And the whole question of, you know, the rights of the parent who has custody and the other parent, access rights, supervised access, all of this is connected with this. How do you make sure that the right decisions, and they're not easy because parents will have completely different stories about abuse and what happened and what didn't happen. But it's to make sure, let's make sure the child is center stage and is listened to and that the experts listen to them. And it's very surprising if the experts don't listen to the children.
The Women's Aid report is essentially, if I understand it correctly, saying that courts are leaning on the testimony of experts whose expertise may not actually be theirs.
That's what they're saying, that we have to make sure the experts are registered. And they're also, I think, accusing some experts of a sort of an ideological bias that doesn't support, in these cases generally, the mother with the child and is giving access to parents who may be abusive. Very serious.
The story, of course, is in the Mail on Sunday, your paper, John, the instances being cited here of children who disclosed experiences of physical restraint and assault by an abusive parent, but this information either ignored, challenged as its truth, or changed and reported instead of the act of the other parent. I mean, they're fairly egregious errors for a family court to make.
They seem to be, and Sarah Benson of Women's Aid has herself, and frankly, a lot of the information I gain about this area is from Debbie McCann's report in today's paper in the Mail on Sunday. And she feels they're egregious failures. So essentially, as you said, the voices of children are not being heard at all. And it would seem from the Women's Aid report that people without qualifications, sufficient qualifications, are giving evidence to the courts. What chills me somewhat is that our reporter, Debbie McCann, has gone to the Department of Justice and they've gone, oh, yeah, we'll have a look at this report. So this has not been done by the government. This has been done by independent agencies in cooperation with Trinity College, where they have looked at it. And it would appear that the Department of Justice now has to go and read independent reports to deal with major, major problems in the courts, the family courts.
John?
I suppose the final point is, do we have even enough experts? I think if we're calling into question the expertise of these experts, there's been a long-standing issue about, do we have enough social workers? Do we have enough social care workers in Ireland who are able to intervene and support families through all of this process who can provide that kind of expert witness?
I think we probably have the experts, but it's to make sure they're registered. And the other point that Sarah is making and the researchers from Trinity and UCC are saying is, please train these people in understanding domestic and gender-based violence. Make sure that there's training, you know, that they get the dynamics of what goes on in families when there is domestic violence.
By the way, if the government actions, as outlined in the papers today, are to stimulate the people's desire to be landlords, if the texts are anything to go by, it may not yet have achieved that. Texts say 25 years as a private landlord, got out in October 2024, took 3 months to get a tenant out. The RTB is a tenant's charter. Never again someone else can fix it. Well, if you've a view, 53106 or 087-1400-106. Big thank you to Francis Fitzgerald, former Thonista, John Mulvihill, digitalisation lead at Siemens, and John Lee, executive editor at the Daily Mail Group in Ireland.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.